Good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it is October, I just said it, 9th. It is the 9th. Oh, it is the 7th. Yeah, the 9th is next time. Okay, so Tuesday the 7th, we're going to start nervous system. We got 3 lectures on nervous system when we look at the schedule right here. And today is a Tuesday, and I notice you have your next exam on a Tuesday. And how many Tuesdays away is that? 2 weeks is your next lecture exam. Going to cover chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. 9 is not a really long chapter, but it's not going to cover 10, which is sensory physiology. It will go up through autonomic nervous system, which is chapter 9. All right, so does anybody have a question on the schedule? The next test, 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9. Okay, the sign-in sheet is going around. It's not the usual kind of sign-in sheet, but we just started it here. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And do we have any announcements from SI?
No, regular sessions Tuesdays and Thursday mornings.
Excellent, just regular sessions. Okay, good. Do I see any other questions out there? No, I do not. All right, well, let's get started with nervous system. I would guess most of this, well, some part of this lecture is going to be review from anatomy for you. All right, but I'll try to cover everything that might be a little bit new. All right, so nervous system. Nervous system has, since it's a living system, it's made up of cells. And there are 2 basic kind of cells that make up the nervous system. There are neurons, and then there are support cells. Neurons receive information and then send electrical impulses long distances in your body, while the support cells do other kinds of things, but they don't send nerve impulses anywhere. All right, so they support the job of what the neurons do. So there are basically 2 kinds. And just like there are 2 different kinds of cells, we could divide the whole nervous system into 2 general locations, and I'm sure you're aware of where these things are. There is central nervous system, and there is, what's the other one?
Peripheral.
Yeah, peripheral nervous system. And of course, you should know what the definition of central is. Central means brain and spinal cord, and peripheral means everything outside the brain and spinal cord. Okay, so that's pretty easy. So there are nerves that leave the brain. What do we call nerves that leave the brain into the periphery, into peripheral nervous system? Okay. Oh, yeah, they are efferent. Very good. They are efferent. But as a class, I even want to know, if there are afferent nerves that enter the brain, how do we think of those nerves that enter or leave the brain? What do we call those nerves? Okay. Let me ask another question. What do we call nerves that leave the spinal cord, that leave or enter the spinal cord? What do we call those nerves? Those are spinal nerves. And now you probably remember the answer to the first question. What do we call nerves that enter or leave the brain? Those are cranial nerves. Yeah, so we got cranial nerves and spinal nerves, depending on where they exit. Okay, so the separation between peripheral and central is right where they leave the brain, or as they leave the spinal cord. And there could be one cell that's partly in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. We'll take a look at that. All right, so we got those 2 kinds of cells. We got neurons and then glial cells. Neurons are what we consider the functional units of the nervous system because they receive information. They actually, you can almost think that they think about the information, but they analyze the information, and then if it's important, they'll send it on to other neurons. All right, so neurons are sometimes what we consider the functional units of the nervous system, but people are becoming more and more interested in the support cells because we're learning of the vast number of jobs that those do, but even though they don't send electrical impulses anywhere. And that probably explains why there are 5 times more common, glial cells are 5 times more common than neurons in the nervous system because they do such amazing work, which we're going to talk about. Okay, first let's talk about neurons. They're characterized by sending electrical nerve impulses. That distinguishes them from glial cells or the support cells. All right, so they can respond to stimulus. They send electrochemical impulses. And those are what we're going to call nerve impulses. We're going to start with knowing what an action potential is, and when an action potential moves along an axon, then it becomes a nerve impulse. So a nerve impulse is an action potential in motion. And at the end of the sending unit of the neuron, then that neuron usually releases a chemical messenger signal from that cell, and then that chemical messenger signal diffuses to a neighboring cell and passes that information on. So what do we call a chemical messenger that's released by a neuron? A neurotransmitter. And could you give me the name of a specific neurotransmitter that you might be aware of? Acetylcholine is a really good example, and that's used at all neuromuscular junctions, all motor neurons that send electrical impulses to a skeletal muscle release acetylcholine, right? And then that acetylcholine will excite that muscle into contracting. All right, so here we have a couple shapes of various kinds of axons, and you should know the shape of three. I only see two illustrated on this illustration, right? The A and B. Does anybody recognize A, what the shape of this cell is, of this neuron? Okay, this is a multipolar. Here is the cell body, contains the nucleus. This is the center of the cell where most of the metabolic activity takes place, where proteins are synthesized, where neurotransmitters are synthesized to the largest degree. And attached to the cell body, we have these shorter processes. And a process is what? Just an extension of some major part of a bone or an extension from a cell. It's a projection. And these short ones that are highly branched, these are what we call dendrites. Then we also see another process that is really long. And sometimes it bifurcates or split into two. But when it gets down to the axon terminus, there is a lot of branching that can take place. So all of these are axonal terminals, and you can see that there is a swelling on each one of these terminals, and we're going to look at that in just a little bit. And the dendrites don't have that swelling at the tips, right? So that's only a characteristic of an axonal terminal. I see another kind of cell besides a neuron. I see another kind of cell that's wrapping itself around the axon. So that's a support cell, and depending on where this cell is located, central or peripheral nervous system, then this cell has a different name. But by the structure, I can tell that these things are Schwann cells, and that's what we find in the peripheral nervous system. Schwann cells are only in the peripheral nervous system, and they wrap something that acts like insulation around the axon. All right, and here is an arrow on that axon. And is it a bidirectional arrow or just a unidirectional arrow? Yeah, so impulses can only travel in one direction, right? And it is always from the cell body, right, down toward the axon terminal, and never the reverse. We're going to find out why that is. It has to do with a refractory period. So the sending end of the neuron is the axon, the receiving end is a dendrite. So dendrites will be responsible for detecting chemical messengers, like neurotransmitters from neighboring cells. All right, the bottom one. Oh, where do we find these multipolar neurons? What kind of function? Since this is physiology, that should really be like right on the tip of your tongue. A multipolar neuron is important for motor. It's an efferent neuron. But it's also for association. Sometimes these multipolar neurons are contained completely within the central nervous system, and we're going to call that an interneuron. Anybody know another name for interneuron? Maybe I'm not speaking the language that you learned. Okay, association or interneuron, right, are the same. Association or interneuron. Interneuron means what? It's a neuron between two other neurons. And that forms an association between those different neurons. All right, the shape of B, cell number B, one on the bottom, is not multipolar. Anybody know what the shape of this one is here? I see one process coming out of the cell body, so sometimes it's called a unipolar, right? Because of this one process. Sometimes it's called a pseudo-unipolar, because there's one process coming out, but the process bifurcates into a receiving end, that has dendrites and a transmitting end that has axon terminals. And you see an arrow showing the pathway of conduction for that pseudo unipolar neuron. Do you see an arrow? Direction of conduction? Yes, there's one right here. And is it two ways or one way? It's always one way, right? And it always goes from dendrite to axon terminus. And the axon and the dendrite are myelinated. That's going to be important to know. All right, so the cell body, let's talk about the function. What's the function of a pseudo-unipolar neuron? That's actually fairly easy. There's only one. Okay, it is sensory. It is for afferent, right? So it's information from the periphery where we have dendrites, right, into this spinal cord and into the central nervous system. All right, so sometimes we call this process that has dendrites the peripheral process because it's in the periphery of your body, not central nervous system. And then sometimes we call this process over here the central process. Why would we call this the central process? Because it is inside the central nervous system, right? So it's not any more complicated than that. And information always flows from dendrites towards cell body into the axon, then down to the axon terminus. That is how electrical information flows. And we're going to see there's two kinds of flowing information, depending on whether it is a dendrite in cell body or if it is an axon. Did I flip slides right here? I did. Okay, so here is the cell body. And if there is a group of nerve cell bodies, and we do have groups of nerve cell bodies in our central nervous system, and those we call a nucleus, right? Or a whole bunch of nuclei, or a whole bunch of different kinds of plural is nuclei, like the basal nuclei. Unfortunately, most of you take an anatomy with a textbook where they haven't changed that terminology over. There are structures inside the brain, which is a group of nerve cell bodies, so they're gray, it's gray matter. But the older terminology is basal ganglia. In today's nomenclature, what would you like to call all the basal ganglia? Those are really basal nuclei, right? So if you use that term, that's fine. Everybody should know exactly what you're talking about. Those are the gray areas in the center part of the brain. All right, so that group of nerve cell bodies in the CNS is a nucleus. If there's a group of these pseudo-unipolar neurons in the peripheral nervous system, we're going to call that a ganglia. Or maybe it could be some other kind of neuron. As long as they're cell bodies, they're all grouped together, that is a ganglia. Do you have any memory of looking at a ganglion anywhere in anatomy? Where did you run into a ganglion? Okay. Oh, yeah, the autonomic nervous system has this sympathetic chain ganglia. It's like the autonomic nervous system spinal cord that runs on either side of the vertebral column, and they have those nodes, all right, which are called the sympathetic chain ganglia. There's some other ganglia from the sympathetic nervous system in front of the spinal cord. Those are what we call the prevertebral, meaning in front of the vertebral column. Those are ganglia. But the most common, probably, that I would have thought, maybe you would have thought of first, is the, okay, just groan when I tell you this because you know it, the dorsal root ganglion. Okay, the dorsal root ganglion on the root that brings information into the spinal cord, right? So is that consistent with what we said the function of this pseudo-unipolar neuron is? The dorsal root is sensory. And the pseudo-unipolar neuron is a sensory neuron. It's a 100% sensory neuron. Okay. All right, so dendrites receive information. And the simplest case and the most prevalent case is that dendrites will have proteins in the cell membrane that are receptors for other kinds of signaling compounds, like other neurotransmitters. Those other neurotransmitters, we would consider them to be a ligand. A ligand binds to a receptor, and then it changes the physiology of the cell by setting up an electrical signal in the cell. All right, so dendrites receive, they convey that information. So here our dendrites convey that information to the cell body. And the reason why, okay, they do that is because they have ligand-gated channels. So we want to remember something about this cell membrane. What can move through a cell membrane, including a neuron cell membrane? What can move through a membrane without any difficulty? Polar or nonpolar? Nonpolar. And what can you tell me about an ion? Is that nonpolar or polar? It is polar. So ions cannot move across the cell membrane, even though there's a huge concentration difference from inside to the outside. So these things would love to diffuse across the membrane, but they can't because they're polar. All right. But if there's a ligand-gated channel, once the ligand binds to that receptor, a channel opens, and then sodium can rush inside the cell. Potassium can rush outside the cell. And we're going to see even calcium. Okay. Oh, what can you tell me about calcium? This is tough because you have to remember way back when. Is calcium equal on either side of the cell membrane? No. Where is it higher? Outside. Right? And it's almost zero on the inside. So that's a huge difference. And remember, the concentration gradient is directly related to the rate of diffusion. And so that's a huge concentration gradient. So calcium will rush into the cell, all right, through these ligand-gated channels. Okay, axons conduct impulses away from the cell body because they have a different kind of channel. Again, here is an axon. And there are differences in ions across the cell membrane that determine the resting membrane potential. Those ions cannot move across the membrane all by themselves, even though there's a huge concentration difference. But every once in a while, if the stimulus is just right, there are channels that open up that allow the diffusion of sodium and potassium through the cell membrane. And that channel is controlled by the voltage on the membrane. All right, so it's not a ligand binding to something. It is just the electrical charge across the membrane can open or close these particular channels. And so those we call voltage-gated channels. So what's important for you to know is that dendrites have ligand-gated channels. They respond to signaling molecules. The axons have voltage-gated channels. They respond to changes in membrane voltage or membrane potential. Two different kinds of channels. And guess who determines what goes where? It is the nucleus in the cell body, okay? Because that controls all the structure and function inside the cell. So remember, two kinds of channels, ligand-gated versus voltage-gated, and what their function is. All right, and those electrical signals, right, move very rapidly over the cell. Well, sometimes large things or a large amount of things have to move within a cell. So there are different ways other than electrical impulses that move things around. There are two main classes. There's exoplasmic flow and there is axonal transport. You remember any kind of organelle inside the cell that's responsible for moving things around inside the cell? Microtubules, yeah, it's like the monorail system inside the cell. All right, so that's going to be a part of axonal transport. There's microtubules involved with that. Exoplasmic flow is going to be more like your digestive system or your digestive tract. How does material move through your digestive tract? In one word. It is called peristalsis. That's right. So exoplasmic flow is more like peristalsis. It moves soluble compounds toward the nerve endings via these rhythmic contractions of an axon. And, of course, that's controlled by the microtubules inside the cell or the axon as well. All right, so rhythmic contractions, that's exoplasmic flow. Axonal transport requires microtubules once again, right? But it is, in this particular case, right, it's not for soluble compounds, but for things that are insoluble inside the cell or actually too big to dissolve in the cytosol. All right, so there are two kinds of axonal transport, and we said moves large molecules or insoluble ones, and it can go either direction. It can go from the cell body down to an axon terminus or an axon terminus back to the cell body, and since that direction, those two directions are opposite and different from each other, we give them two different names. The forward direction is what we call anterograde. The reverse direction is what we call retrograde. Right? So retrograde is reverse. Anterograde or forward moves materials away from the cell body, down an axon, for instance, and it uses a particular protein that acts as a motor. It attaches to a microtubule, and it also attaches to a packet of stuff that needs to move down the axon. That motor protein is called a kinesin. So kinesins are important for anterograde transport. And for retrograde transport, there's a different kind of protein that goes the other way, and that's called a dynein. All right, so you got kinesins and dyneins. These attach themselves to microtubules, and they can move large particles, insoluble particles, or pieces of organelles around, up and down the axon. And as a matter of fact, there are some viruses and maybe some other toxins that know how to attach themselves to a dynein, and when they do, where does that virus end up? Do they end up at an axon terminus or in the cell body? Okay, if they attach themselves to a dynein, that moves materials toward the cell body. So that is just one route that viruses have to get into the cell body and have access to the genetic material inside that neuron. And then they can take over the function of that particular cell. So these things are pretty important. I got to put a couple YouTube videos on what these things look like. We can see them crawling around in a simulation, crawling around various microtubules inside the cell. That's pretty cool. All right. Functional classification of neurons. Neurons usually fall into three classifications, and I see two on this particular illustration. I wish I would see three, but I see two. Here I see a pseudo-unipolar neuron, and what did we say that was for? Sensory, right? Afferent, 100%, and is that the direction of the arrow? Yes, because in this, I think you told me this was a beige color, and this color over here is like blue, is that right? Is that good enough? Can you see the difference? Blue represents central nervous system. This beige represents peripheral nervous system. So the sensory neuron has dendrites in the peripheral nervous system, and then it enters the spinal cord. And when it does, then it's inside the central nervous system. So the sensory neuron is partly in the PNS and partly in the CNS, because that's just how it goes. All right, a multipolar neuron. We see the cell body is in the central nervous system, but it exits right through a spinal nerve, for instance, and it ends up in the peripheral nervous system. And then I see that it goes to a skeletal muscle. Right? There are not receptors in this neuron because I can see little swellings on these axon terminals. So here's a nice axon. Here's an axon terminus. And what kind of neuron takes information to a skeletal muscle? We're going to call that the asomatic motor neuron. Not an autonomic, but somatic, because it goes to skeletal muscles. Skeletal muscles are not deep inside body cavities. They're more on your surface. All right, and so people think of that more as not deep tissue, but your body tissue. And soma means what? Soma means body. Right. Okay, so it has some kind of strange connotations. That's just one way to think of somatic. Somatic is not belonging to something deep inside cavities or deep inside visceral cavities, right? And those are cavities not open to the outside world. So how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to a skeletal muscle? Do you see that? How many? Yes, your answer is correct, but does everybody else see that? Because that will help you when we get to chapter 7, which is, I think, the last chapter for the test coming up. All right, so here's a cell body and an axon, and it goes all the way to a skeletal muscle. So that somatic motor neuron pathway is only a single neuron. I see some other multipolar neurons in this third row. And now how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands, or glands? I see two. And that's a characteristic of the autonomic outflow pathway. Not somatic, but autonomic. And what does autonomic mean in terms of voluntary or involuntary? It's involuntary. Somatic also has a connotation of being voluntary, right? Okay. So these skeletal muscles, when you tell a skeletal muscle to contract, since it's voluntary, it will always contract if it's healthy. It can never make up its own mind. There is so much neurotransmitter released by these axon terminals, and there are so many receptors in this junction between a neuron and a muscle that we call the neuromuscular junction. There are so many ligand-gated channels that always causes an excitatory event on a skeletal muscle and causes contraction. So if you send a nerve impulse down to a skeletal muscle, guess what it does? All the time. It contracts, right? It can't look around for other kinds of information to figure out what to do. It just blindly and immediately contracts. Can't make up its mind what to do. Unlike the autonomic nervous system that goes to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands, right? Because it's autonomic, how many divisions in the autonomic nervous system are you aware of? There are two. And what's the relationship between those two? How, one word, the opposite, I like opposite, maybe a little bit better word. I like that word, I heard it, they are antagonistic to each other, right? So smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, some parts of the heart and glands have dual innervation, which means they get signals from the sympathetic as well as the parasympathetic nervous system. They go to these glands and smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, and some of these tissues, right, can integrate that information up and make a decision on what to do. So even though we send an excitatory signal to a smooth muscle, it might not contract depending on other signals that it's receiving from other parts of the body. And is that a lot different than skeletal muscle? Yes, because the skeletal muscle, when it's told to contract, it just does right away, right? It has no other opportunity to do anything else. Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands looks at the balance of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system to figure out what it should be doing at a particular time. Skeletal muscle only contracts. The kind of neuron that's missing from this illustration right here is an association neuron. It's always going to be completely contained within the spinal cord or the brain. And probably you've seen a picture of that. Even the first day when we were talking about homeostasis, right, that integration center is usually an association neuron. Here are the three shapes of neurons. We talked about multipolar, and we talked about pseudo-unipolar. Right, so multipolar is motor and association. The pseudo-unipolar is sensory. But here is another one. Right, and this is what we call a bipolar. So this is a true bipolar cell, and we have these in some organs for special sensation. Does anybody know what special sensation is? Actually, just give me an example, not necessarily a definition, but could you give me an example of a special sense?
Sight.
Hearing, I like that. Sight, I heard that over here too. Taste is a special sense, right? They use these kinds of neurons, the bipolar neurons, and that's about the only place where we find those. Okay. All right, so that's an introduction to neurons. So make sure you know their shapes and what their function is and some other things. Like, for instance, a somatic motor pathway goes to what kind of effector organ? This is good question. What's the effector organ for somatic motor system? Skeletal muscle, only skeletal muscle, right? What's an effector organ for an autonomic outflow pathway? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. Yeah, you should have those three on the tip of your tongue. Okay. All right, let's talk about some of the support cells. And remember, there are two places of the nervous system. There's central and peripheral, so we might break things down into those two places. So here, what kind of neuron does this look like? What is this like? Pseudo-unipolar? Bipolar? Multipolar. So here's a nice multipolar neuron with a bunch of dendrites. Been kind of chopped off, that's okay. And one long axon has been chopped off too. All right, nucleus in the soma. And around the axon, I see some of these, are these beige? Is that beige? White? Off-white? Beige? Okay. These cells will wrap themselves around an axon. And I see many layers of that wrapping. And that this part of the cell contains a compound called myelin. It's a lipid. And that lipid is an insulator that keeps the electrical properties of the axon inside the Schwann cell different from the electrical properties outside the cell. So electrical currents cannot move in or out of the axon when it's underneath a Schwann cell. And I think you're familiar with that, because when you want to unplug your toaster, do you worry about getting electrocuted? Yes, you do. I know I had a toaster like that too. But say it's a brand new toaster. When you unplug it, or maybe you have an iron and you want to unplug it, you're going to grab those electrical wires. You have to worry about getting electrocuted? And my thinking is, no, because what's on those wires? There is insulation, there's rubber or plastic around those wires, so electricity can't get out of that wire into your body, it just goes into the iron or toaster. So think of these Schwann cells as being like that insulation around wires that you have all over your house. And these Schwann cells are found in the peripheral nervous system. So this example right here would not be an association neuron. This would be a somatic motor neuron, or it could be an autonomic motor neuron too, multipolar. So here we have layers of myelin, which is insulation. And here is the outermost layer with this nucleus of the Schwann cell. This outer layer has the cytoplasm that keeps the cell alive. So there's cytosol and organelles right in this outermost layer. Sometimes this outermost layer of a Schwann cell is called the neurolemma. Is that ringing a bell for anybody? Neurolemma? Yeah, the neurolemma is this outermost shell around these inner layers that we call the myelin sheath. Right. Now these Schwann cells are not continuous. You see big gaps, actually maybe small gaps between these cells. These are special gaps. They have a special function, and they're called nodes of Ranvier. Right. So this particular cell can transmit electrical information, not just as a signal that has to move molecule by molecule by molecule, but it actually skips down an axon, skip, 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 which means that a nerve impulse travels a lot faster. Maybe we talked about that in anatomy, maybe not, but that's special. What would you rather have, fast neurons or slow neurons? Sounds like one of those commercials. What's better? Fast or slow? Okay. Fast. Yeah, fast is much better. All right. And so myelinated axons is a modern development for nerve impulse conduction because it conducts very fast. That kind of conduction where it skips from node to node is what we call saltatory conduction. If it's a non-myelinated axon, we don't have saltatory conduction. We have continuous conduction. Continuous, and continuous conduction is slow. We have some neurons in our body like that, and we're going to probably look at those in the autonomic nervous system chapter. All right, so this is a Schwann cell. What, is a Schwann cell a neuron or a support cell? Support cell. It doesn't transmit an electrical impulse, but you can see that it greatly enhances how an axon can transmit an electrical impulse, even though a Schwann cell doesn't all by itself. All right. Oh, and here I see that Schwann cell wrapping itself around an axon, and I see fascicles inside of this this neuron as well. And here's the cytoplasm with the nucleus, and eventually it gets pushed all pinched to the outermost layer, and that inner layer right here is the sheath. This outer layer is, right here. The outer layer is the neurolemma. Okay, and it causes electrical insulation for that neuron. There is another cell, satellite cell, and I don't have an illustration of a satellite cell. Maybe I'll point out where you find them. They're easy to find and see in a dorsal root ganglion. Okay, and we're looking at cells in the peripheral nervous system, and did I use that term correctly? Dorsal root ganglion. Is that peripheral or central nervous system? Yeah, ganglion is peripheral. So I use that term properly because we're looking at that group of nerve cell bodies that is still in the peripheral nervous system, dorsal root ganglia. Maybe you could go back and look at your spinal cord anatomy just a little bit. All right, so here now, let's jump to central nervous system. So that was easy. Only two cells in the peripheral nervous system support neurons. But in the central nervous system, all right, we've got four major categories of cells that don't transmit electrical impulses but somehow enhance or direct the activity of neurons. All right, and these particular cells are, let's take a look at this. So here's the neuron, right? Nerve cell body, dendrites. Here's an axon. Let me ask you a quick question. What end of a neuron is the axon? So you got two choices. What end? In terms of function, in terms of function. Is it sending or receiving? The axon is sending, right? What's the receiving end? Yeah, dendrites. Okay, yeah. Don't forget that. We're not going to talk about that directly here, but we're going to talk about these support cells. Here I see some myelin sheaths laid down, just like the Schwann cells, almost. But a Schwann cell can operate only on one axon at a time in one location, but this oligodendrocyte can put myelin insulation at different locations, a number of locations on one axon, but it can also myelinate a neighboring axon. So that's a lot different than a Schwann cell, right? But it still produces myelin, and the function of it is still the same. It does what for a nerve impulse when there's an oligodendrocyte that has myelinated an axon in the central nervous system? What is it doing? It's making what out of this axon? It's converting it from a slow one to a fast one, because that nerve impulse is going to jump from node to node. All right, that's the job of oligodendrocyte. So I think that's a review from anatomy. You should know, where do you find oligodendrocytes? Where do you find oligodendrocytes? You've got two choices, PNS or CNS. Yeah, central nervous system, right? So you're going to see that has all these different little branching patterns. And somebody with multiple sclerosis that's in an active form, it is these cells that are being attacked or degenerating for some reason, and the myelin sheath in a certain part of somebody's brain, central nervous system, degenerates, and that just messes up the timing of transmission of signals, right? And I think multiple sclerosis can even attack Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system as well, and that messes up the electrical conduction in those axons. All right, so that's oligodendrocyte. And the next one, astrocyte. Here I see a cell body, and it's got projections, almost like this oligodendrocyte. I see some of the projections move over to a neuron, and I see other projections from the same cell moving over to a blood vessel. And this blood vessel is labeled a capillary. What's the function of a capillary? Maybe from anatomy you remember, I'm sure you were told this. It's got a special function. Exchange. Things can enter or leave a blood vessel only through a capillary, not through a vein or an artery. Flash back to what those walls look like. Walls of a vein or an artery are way too thick to allow for diffusion. Only capillaries are thin. As a matter of fact, maybe you remember that a capillary is just made up of a simple squamous epithelium that we call endothelium, right? The endothelium of a blood vessel is just a simple squamous, which means, what is it, thick or thin? If it's simple squamous, it's thin. That kind of epithelium is designed for exchange. All right, so things can leave a capillary and go into the brain, but that means that anything that can diffuse out of the circulatory system can go into the brain, including toxic compounds, or bacteria, or other kinds of intoxicants. And it is a good idea to protect your brain from damaging kinds of chemicals. Why is that? Because you need to maintain consciousness, right? Every second of your life. If you can't afford to give away brain power, brain processing power at any particular time. So these neurons have to operate to keep you normal. So these processes, these perivascular feet that surround the capillary, make up something we call the blood-brain barrier. That's an important point. Astrocytes make up a blood-brain barrier, so they restrict what kinds of compounds can leave the blood and enter the brain. That's a really good thing. Sometimes it's not a really good thing because maybe somebody needs a drug in the brain to fight a particular disease process, and that drug cannot get across the blood-brain barrier, and then that patient's brain doesn't have access to that drug. And it's really expensive to figure out how to build a drug that does its work inside the brain but can also get across the blood-brain barrier. So that's something really important when people are designing drugs. All right, what is something else with an astrocyte? It can take compounds that the cell needs from this capillary and do a door-to-door delivery of that compound from a capillary right to this cell body. What do you think of, what would be one example of a compound that this neuron would like to have from the blood? Oxygen. Yeah, oxygen diffuses so fast that it probably doesn't need any kind of special transport. Same thing for CO2. It diffuses across membranes so fast. But I'm thinking of a solute in particular that you know has difficulty moving across membranes, and that is glucose. Yeah, so astrocytes can actually take up glucose and deliver it directly to this neuron, right, so that it can make ATP from it. And other kinds of compounds as well. Astrocytes can recycle neurotransmitters so that this neuron can resynthesize neurotransmitters easily and quickly. This astrocyte can also secrete compounds that will direct where this neuron goes and what kind of branching pattern these dendrites have. All right? And so that is just one way that we understand a learning process. When you learn new information, the structure of your brain has to change. Probably the number of neurons does not change significantly in most parts of the brain, but the branching of these dendrites, right, does change dramatically, and the branching pattern determines the network that's inside your brain, which is the function of your brain. Right? And so the astrocyte will release compounds that will cause for the growth of these dendrites that increases processing power of your brain, and that's one way that we can think of learning, when this astrocyte, right, starts to make new connections between neurons. So in this class, what can you tell me about your brain in August compared to December? Is it going to be the same? No, it's not going to be the same. By structure, it's not going to be the same, which means what? It's not going to be the same by function either. And I'm just amazed that all you guys turn your brains over to instructors to change like that. But you do. I guess you have no choice, right? If you want to become certified in some specialized field. All right, so it's the job of the astrocyte to help rebuild your brain, right, and in the process of learning, long-term memory. All right, so we got oligodendrocyte, we got astrocyte, and what's another one? Got two more. Here we have microglia. Was there a question? Anybody had a question? Microglia. All right, microglia looks like a dendritic cell that we see in the epidermis. And a dendritic cell is an immune cell, and it looks for things that don't belong in the brain, or maybe brain cells that are dead or damaged, and it will phagocytize and destroy and recycle the building blocks so that these neurons and other cells can use those building blocks again for whatever purpose they need. All right, so microglia cell is an immune cell. Did you have a good sense of what immune cell is? It's for protection, right? So it's a protection cell. Does a microglial cell send electrical impulses? No, that's not its job. What kind of cell in the nervous system sends electrical impulses? Only a neuron? Yes, only a neuron. This is true. I was trying to trick you. But a neuron has what? Dendrites and axons. And you should know which way information goes. Dendrite to cell body to axon. All right, so microglia, not too hard to explain. The last one we have right here is an ependymal cell. And I see here a big space inside the brain, and I don't see any cells in here. All right, so this big, what are these big spaces called inside the brain that only contain fluid? Okay, the fluid is CSF, but I tell you what, before we leave that, what does CSF mean? Yeah, cerebrospinal, not cerebral, right, but cerebro, because we need that O in there to combine what? The brain and the spinal cord, or cerebrum and the spinal cord. So we find this fluid in both places, right, so here is cerebrospinal fluid, right, and in the brain, where is that found? It's in some kind of chamber. What do we call that chamber? Ventricle, yeah. And so you know what the lateral ventricles, third ventricle, fourth, you know, some passageways like the aqueduct between the ventricles. And that fluid is produced by these ependymal cells. So ependymal cells line all of the ventricles. And in certain locations, there are capillaries that join with the ependymal cells, and it takes plasma from the capillary, processes that plasma, and secretes it into the ventricle. Right? So when you have an association between ependymal cells and a capillary that makes cerebrospinal fluid, what do we call that structure in the brain? You're going to have to help me because I haven't thought about it since before summer. Oh, I remembered what it is. What do we call that structure? What do you call that structure in the brain that makes cerebrospinal fluid? It's called the choroid plexus. Choroid plexus. You're all familiar with that. Okay. So now you know how a choroid plexus is made. It's made with ependymal cells and a capillary, and that produces cerebrospinal fluid, which is a little bit different than plasma. Right? But there should never be any red blood cells going into a ventricle, right, through choroid plexus. There shouldn't be any white blood cells, except for some that can crawl around, like a macrophage. But most cells just stay inside this capillary through the choroid plexus. Okay. So we talked about those four kinds of support cells, oligodendrocytes, astrocytes, microglia, ependymal cells. Where do we find those, CNS or PNS? Yeah, central nervous system. All right, and they're all involved with maintaining or promoting growth or some kind of regulation of neurons inside the central nervous system. All right, we talked about all this stuff already. Here we just have that nice multipolar neuron, node of Ranvier, myelinated region, neurolemma, axonal regeneration. Okay, let's look at this for just a second. Axonal regeneration occurs more readily in the peripheral nervous system than central nervous system. And usually when a neuron gets damaged, it's damage to an axon because an axon is really, really long. It has a lot of spaces, a lot of opportunity to become damaged. And when that nerve is damaged or that axon is damaged, it would be nice to repair or regrow that axon so that whatever effect or organ is going to receives information to do its job. Right, like if it's a skeletal muscle and that axon is severed, then the skeletal muscle won't contract. Well, it'd be nice to get that skeletal muscle back operating again, right? Especially if it's the diaphragm. What good is the diaphragm? That's a muscle. You guys know that. What's it important for? Inspiration, yeah, a part of breathing. Inspiration, and can you tell me the name of the nerve? You should know this. What nerve goes to the diaphragm? Okay. The phrenic nerve. Yeah, phrenic nerve goes to the diaphragm. Do you know where the phrenic nerve comes from? This is good. You might have to know this on a board exam because it's pretty good common information to know. Where does the phrenic nerve come from? It's a spinal nerve. It's not a cranial nerve. From C3, 4, and 5. Remember C3, 4, and 5? And what's that? There's a little saying to help you remember that. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive, right? So remember that little saying. And so it goes through the cervical nerve plexus, gets information from C3, 4, and 5 to make the phrenic nerve. All right, so regeneration does happen more readily in the peripheral nervous system than the central nervous system, and it has something to do with a cell that's always associated with an axon. What's the difference between central and peripheral nervous system in terms of support cells and an axon? That's kind of like a critical thinking question. See if you're putting information together. What's the difference? Oh, I heard it. Oligodendrocyte versus Schwann cell. Oligodendrocytes you have in the CNS, Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system, and they behave differently. All right. Oligodendrocytes produce proteins that inhibit regrowth. Right, and they just form a scar that blocks the regrowth. So it actually interrupts the pathway where an axon was going in the central nervous system. And once again, what is central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. So when somebody has spinal cord injury, because there are oligodendrocytes in the spinal cord, it does not regenerate because of those oligodendrocytes. But nerves, right, in your periphery can regenerate, not all the time, but if it's not too drastic a severing of a nerve, it can regrow. All right, and why is that? All right, so here I see a nice multipolar neuron, injury to it, and this is a going to skeletal muscle, so this is what, a nice somatic motor neuron, and it gets severed. Here's a Schwann cell, that's damaged as well, so we got pieces of axon, pieces of Schwann cells, and so this distal part degenerates and is eaten up by white blood cells, macrophages, right, it's phagocytized, and then the remnants of these pieces are used to build new Schwann cells, and those Schwann cells just form together to form a tube going back to this skeletal muscle, and this tube is what we call a regeneration tube. So this is something that Schwann cells readily do, right, when that axon is damaged, and now you have the axon going all the way back to that effector organ, but oligodendrocytes cannot do that. As a matter of fact, they inhibit that kind of process. Right? If this was in the central nervous system, oh, you see some, what's happening to this neuron cell body? It's swelling up, right, because it's damaged. Can you see it damaged? An oligodendrocyte in the central nervous system is not going to form a regeneration tube, but it's actually going to form a cap over this axon preventing regeneration. And you're probably wondering, oh, well, that doesn't sound so good. But that's probably a very important control mechanism to prevent the growth or the uncontrolled growth of nervous tissue in your brain. So what do we call uncontrolled growth of some part of your body? That would be a tumor, right? So that prevents tumor genesis in the brain. That's the job of that oligodendrocyte. And furthermore, you should probably be aware of that. If you have a tumor and cells can break away from that tumor, go to another spot in your body and form another tumor, what do we call that? Then that is, yeah, metastasis, that's produced by a cancer, right? So a tumor is not necessarily cancerous, right? It has to have that metastasis function associated with it to be cancer. All right. Neurotrophins. I talked about this a little bit. Neurotrophins are secreted by astrocytes, right? And it promotes fetal nerve growth. And even neonates. It promotes nerve growth in the neonate, and that's probably the thing that grows the most in a newborn, is their brain. Their head grows very, very fast. Their brain grows very, very fast. And if you look at the proportion of a neonate's brain, at least in the first year, compared to the rest of their body, their head is huge compared to the rest of their body, right? And then their body kind of catches up, and then their head sort of has the normal kind of volume. And so those are due to neurotrophins. These are stimulating compounds secreted by astrocytes. These are also important if there is damage to an axon in the central nervous system. Neurotrophins are important for regeneration in some cases. And neurotrophins are even required for just the survival of many kinds of neurons in the brain. So without neurotrophins from astrocytes, then somebody will lose neurons in the brain. And that's not a very good thing. Okay, or it could cause atrophy or even death of neurons inside the central nervous system. And we know now that there is an affective disorder called clinical depression, and we know that certain parts of, unfortunately, that patient's brain degenerate, and when they can regenerate, right, when certain neurotrophins are released into that area, and that relieves that person of clinical depression. There are some drugs that do that pretty nicely. So these neurotrophins are hugely important. Okay, astrocytes. What are some other things that astrocytes do? Buffers potassium levels. Why do you think that's important? Buffer means just maintain at a proper concentration. What do you know potassium to be important for? Have you ever looked at it before? Have you looked at potassium before? Yeah? Probably because you remember that the sodium potassium ATP pump all over your body is what uses up most of the energy that we consume, right? Just that sodium potassium ATP pump. It's necessary to maintain resting membrane potential. It's necessary to keep cells acting like a battery And if it loses that membrane potential, just like when a battery loses its charge, how do you think about that battery? It's dead, right? That cell is dead too without that resting membrane potential. These astrocytes, I mentioned this before, can recycle neurotransmitters. So here we have a neuron-neuron junction. This junction between neurons is what we call a synapse, and the chemical that transmits the information from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic neuron is a neurotransmitter, and astrocytes sometimes take up the breakdown products, right, of that neurotransmitter, or even that neurotransmitter once again, and bring it to this axon terminus so that the axon terminus never runs out of neurotransmitter, because then it couldn't signal the postsynaptic cell. Regulates adult neurogenesis, just like clinical depression that we talked about. And it can release compounds that regulate neuronal activity. So even though they don't transmit electrical impulses, they can adjust, right, how information is transferred within the, and what kind of nervous system do we see in astrocyte? Central nervous system, right. What else are they important for? Blood-brain barrier. That is a good thing usually. Sometimes it's not such a good thing. For instance, if you have a drug, you need a drug in the brain and it can't get there because of the blood-brain barrier, then that certainly is a problem. Okay. All right. So that covers the cells of the peripheral and central nervous system. Just remember, there are neurons and glial, and glial cells are different in peripheral and central nervous system, though there's some that have pretty much the same kind of function. All right, resting membrane potential. So what's another name for potential? Resting membrane potential is the same thing as resting membrane voltage. Voltage, maybe I heard voltage, I'm not quite sure. Right, and what does that mean? It means that there's a difference of electrical charge across the membrane. One place is more positive compared to the other. Or you could say the other is more negative compared to the former that we just considered. But there's some difference in charge. All right. So remember that, first of all, that what causes that difference in electrical charge is that there are some things inside the cell that can't get out. And it says cations right here, but that is a huge typographical error. Right? Because these large things that are trapped inside the cell are going to attract potassium into the cell. So what kind of charge do these big things have to have in order to attract, potassium inside the cell? They have to be negative, right? Because potassium is positive. And what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract, right? So these large anions are trapped inside the cell. That draws more potassium inside compared to the outside. That helps develop a membrane potential. The sodium-potassium pump is electrogenic. Right? And that is because, are there equal numbers of sodium and potassium moved across the membrane when the sodium potassium ATP pump is operating? No. It is what? It is? How many sodiums go out? There are three. How many potassiums go in? There are only two. So more positive charges leave than enter, which means the inside of the cell becomes more negative because it's not receiving as many positive charges. So that contributes to the resting membrane voltage. And here's something that we haven't talked about too much, but the voltage on the membrane is due in large part to permeability, not just the concentrations across the membrane, which we could calculate with that Nernst equation, but also the permeability. And potassium is permeable, right? Even though it's high inside the cell, because it's attracted to what? Those anions that are inside the cell. And the permeability of potassium and sodium, we're going to see, is managed by various events, by voltage on the membrane and also by various kinds of ligands. So neurons are excitable. So that membrane voltage can change depending on some stimulating events or inhibitory events. A living cell can discharge that membrane voltage very quickly by rapid changes in the permeability to ions. Sodium, remember, what kind of ion is sodium? Cation, right? What's the voltage inside the cell? More positive or negative? More negative. So what does sodium like to do? It likes to go inside the cell to neutralize the electrical charge, but where is sodium at a high concentration, outside or inside? It's high outside as well, so you have the electrical gradient drawing it into the cell, you have the chemical gradient drawing it into the cell. It can't get through a cell membrane because it's a polar compound, but as soon as the sodium channel opens, what happens to sodium? Oh, it rushes inside the cell, right? Because there's negative charges in there. Yeah, good thing. And there's also very little sodium inside the cell compared to the outside. All right, so, and when a positive charge, when sodium enters the cell, what happens to the membrane voltage when a positive charge enters? It becomes less negative. It becomes more positive, right? Because sodium is a cation. All right, neurons and muscles are similar in that they can generate and conduct electrical impulses. So these things are similar, which means that they have some proteins in their cell membranes that are going to be similar, and namely those things are what we call voltage-gated channels. I'm going to talk about those a lot. Okay, so here we have like a TV tube, but this is a fancy kind of voltmeter, right? A voltmeter has two places where it can measure electrical charge, and if there's a difference in electrical charge between those two places, we say there is voltage between those two places. So here we have one electrode inside the cell, another electrode outside the cell. It's going to measure the charge, and when we do, if this is a nice living cell, we're going to see that the inside is negative compared to the outside. And so we're going to use this one outside the cell as like the reference electrode. This is going to be like zero, right? And so if this one is zero, what kind of charge is going to be on the one inside the cell? And the answer would be either positive or negative compared to the zero. What's the charge inside the cell compared to the outside? Yeah, it's going to be negative, right? So we're always going to measure it with respect to this electrode that's outside the cell. And this TV tube is what we call an oscilloscope. And it will just show the magnitude of that voltage or even a change in that voltage across the membrane versus time, because there's going to be a little dot that is moving across the screen constantly. And when there's a change in voltage, that little dot is going to move up and down. Right. And if the cell were dead, where would that little dot be? Would it be at plus 40, minus 40? Would it be at 80, go up to plus 60? Right. If that cell were dead, where would that line be drawn? Right at zero, and it would be what? Flat line. Just be flat. Okay. Okay. But we know, since this is a living cell, that the inside is what? Negative. And for a typical cell, we're going to say it's minus 70 millivolts, if we consider all those things that make the resting membrane voltage. And if we don't do anything to that cell, it's just going to stay at that voltage. So that's what we call the resting membrane potential. That's when this neuron is not doing anything. It's just going to stay constant at minus 70. But is that a dead cell or a living cell? That's a living cell, right? If it was dead, it would have to be zero. Okay. Well, if that voltage across the membrane goes up to zero, right, the voltage is going away, we call that depolarization. From resting membrane potential to zero is depolarization. And as a matter of fact, we consider the deviation from zero and up into the positive region here also depolarization. Right, so anything that goes from a lower level to a higher level on the oscilloscope, we consider that depolarization. And I always want you to associate that with what kind of event, an inhibitory event or excitatory event. Excitatory. If you want to put excitatory, maybe I like that better than stimulation, because a stimulus could be excitatory or inhibitory, so just put excitatory right here. Excitatory stimulus always produces depolarization. Okay. But sometimes we see that there's a deviation to where the membrane voltage becomes more negative. Right? We're going to, from the normal resting, which is minus 70, we call that hyperpolarization. The cell is becoming more polar, right? The inside of the cell is becoming more negative, and when that happens, that's an inhibitory signal. That's an inhibitory event on the cell. It's not going to be excited, or it'd be much more difficult to excite that cell. All right, so remember, if that dot moves up, that's depolarization. If it moves down from RMP, that is hyperpolarization or inhibition. And sometimes, this is not on the graph, but oh, it's over here on the slide, So if we're at resting membrane potential and something happens to the cell, right, and the cell membrane potential moves up to here, what do we call that? So if it goes from RMP to positive 50, that is depolarization, and that is excitatory. Sometimes then the cell recovers, actually most of the time the cell recovers and the voltage goes back down to zero or almost, maybe it wiggles around a little bit before it gets to minus 70, goes back to RMP. That movement from that peak depolarization back down to RMP is what we call repolarization. All right, so depolarization is moving up, hyper is moving down from RMP. Going from a depolarized state to RMP is repolarization, going back to the resting state. So a lot of diagrams we're going to show you, right, is a plot of voltage versus time. Voltage versus time. And these are millivolts. These are not really tiny, tiny voltages. These are fairly easy to measure, even though the cell is very small. It's microscopic. So in order to put an electrode inside this microscopic cell, what can you tell me about this electrode right here? Can it be big? Can this thing be like the electrode you put on your car battery? No. It's got to be microscopic. And those are actually pretty easy to make. You just take a glass tube and stretch out the glass tube really fast, and the tube gets smaller and smaller and smaller before it breaks, and then you have a little microscopic tube. You got to be careful with that because you can't see the tip of it. But it could still, you still could stick it in your body or your eye or whatever. How do you take a glass tube and then be able to stretch it really fast like that? What can you do to glass to make it flow? You heat it up. Yeah, just put it on a Bunsen burner and it gets very fluidy and you can stretch it just like that to make a little electrode. Okay, let's consider some channels. Right, and we're going to call these ion channels because we know that an ion, can an ion move across the cell membrane? No, because they're polar. They need a channel. They need a way. They need a protein that goes across the membrane through which an ion can actually move. So membrane potential changes occur by ion flow through the membrane, like potassium rushing out or sodium rushing in. Right? They need some kind of channel. Some channels are normally open. Some are closed. Potassium, for instance, has a number of channels that are open all the time. And some channels are closed all the time, or they could be open, but they have a special little feature to them to where they can open sometimes or close sometimes. They're going to be controlled by the cell. And those things that can open and close that channel is called a gate. So think of a fence that's a barrier. You can't enter the yard, right, because the fence is there, but you can enter the yard when the gate opens. Same thing for these ions. They can enter the cell when a gate opens. And sometimes that gate is controlled by a ligand. We call that a ligand-gated channel. Sometimes it's controlled by voltage on the membrane. When the membrane voltage changes, that changes a conformation in that protein. And that's what we would call a voltage-gated channel. Right? Voltage-gated channels are opened by depolarization. That's an excitatory event. Right? These voltage-gated potassium channels, well, there are leak channels, and then there's gated channels or closed in resting cells. Sodium channels are voltage-gated. They're closed in resting cells. Right? Only certain kinds of leak channels for potassium are open. So when you look at this slide right here, what's the first thing probably that you recognize, something that you're really familiar with? Phospholipid bilayer, right? A nice permeability barrier allows only polar compounds to move through it, right? And it will restrict the movement of ions and other kinds of polar compounds. But here is a protein, and you can see this protein goes all the way across the membrane. And in this configuration, right, there is not a pathway to go from the outside to the inside of the cell. This channel is what, open or closed? It's closed. Right, and this particular channel is going to be closed when the cell is at rest. What is the membrane potential when the cell is at rest? It's going to be zero outside the cell, but inside the cell it's going to be minus 70. Right, so across the membrane we're just going to say minus 70. When the membrane potential is minus 70, this particular protein takes this conformation, which is closed. All right, now let's look at that same protein. It's still going across the membrane. And now the channel is open. So ions can move by diffusion through this channel, no special carriers. And this channel is open because something changes the voltage across the membrane. And so if there is a change in voltage across the membrane, this particular protein opens up and ions can move in either direction. What's going to rush inside the cell if this is a nice normal cell? Remember, the inside is negative. So sodium is going to rush inside, right? Because it's positive, wants to get together with all those negative charges. Plus, high to low, diffusion is going to cause sodium to enter the cell because this channel is open. And when sodium enters the cell like that, becomes the inside of the cell becomes more negative, what happens to that trace on the oscilloscope when the inside of the cell becomes more positive? Which way does it go? Inside of the cell becomes more positive, right? It drifts up to zero, maybe even becomes positive. What do we call that? Depolarization. And what kind of event is that? That is excitatory or inhibitory, and you know that to be excitatory. Okay. Well, there's another feature on this particular voltage-gated channel, and it is this ball and chain right here. And when the membrane potential reaches a certain voltage, like, well, let me go back, when it goes up really high, really positive over here to this positive region, then this little ball, or there's a change in conformation of this protein, and this little ball gets plugged into this area right here. So even though the channel remains open, right, the channel protein is open, the ball is blocking the movement. All right, so this ball right here is what we call a gate. Right, this gate can be open or closed, and the channel can be open or closed, and we're going to have to appreciate that to know something about an action potential. So this third case, we see that the channel is open, but the gate is closed. So what about diffusion, movement of ions? It stops, right? Okay, and this whole thing gets reset back to this condition when the cell repolarizes. Right? What's repolarization? Going from a depolarized state back to RMP, resting membrane potential. Not to zero, but down to resting membrane potential is repolarization. Oh, wrong way. So I want you to think of a bunch of channels in our body with this kind of look to it, this kind of conformation. So this channel opens and closes depending on the voltage across the membrane, but it also has a gate, so we call this a voltage-gated channel. Voltage-gated channel. All right, so resting membrane potential is just constant. For a typical cell, minus 70 millivolts. But sometimes that voltage changes and it moves around. So we're not going to call that a stationary potential. We're going to call that an action potential, right? A voltage that is moving around on the surface of the cell membrane. And that action potential is due to voltage-gated channels. All right, so just say action potential due to voltage-gated channels, and an action potential is not due to a ligand-gated channel. So remember, there are two kinds of gated channels, ligand and voltage, and for now, I think you're just going to have to memorize voltage-gated channels produce what kind of potential? An action potential, which means what? That it can move around, and we're going to see some special qualities on how it moves around. Okay, so here is an extremely important exam figure, right? The action potential. Action potential just means what? Some change in membrane potential, and it can actually move around. So let's look at the graph first. Here is a graph of membrane voltage versus time. So you could consider this like the face of that oscilloscope. And what is this solid line right here? It's not labeled on this slide, but you should be able to label this. It's constant. Yeah, RMP, here's RMP, minus 70 millivolts. Okay, and if there is an excitatory stimulus, what's going to happen to RMP if it's excitatory? It's going to depolarize, and do we see this potential depolarizing right here? Is that depolarization or hyperpolarization? That's depolarization because it's moving towards zero. The membrane is depolarizing. Okay, and at this time, right, there is something special. Do you notice that the shape of the curve changes dramatically once the depolarization reaches this dotted line? All of a sudden, there's a huge change in membrane potential, right? And again, what do we call this? Repolarization or depolarization? depolarization. Okay, and this is due to sodium rushing inside the cell. So, how can sodium rush inside the cell? When there is a voltage-gated channel opening up, or maybe some other kind of channel. But anyway, whenever the membrane voltage reaches that dotted line value, this voltage-gated channel opens up, and then sodium rushes inside the cell because of what? It's directly related to concentration gradient and electrical gradient. Sodium rushes inside the cell just passively. All right, so here we have depolarization. That's the first part of an action potential. This is due to sodium rushing inside the cell. All right, now the cell becomes positive on the inside. There is another kind of voltage-gated channel now that begins to open up, and it is potassium. All right, and where is potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell. It's high inside the cell. Okay, it's low outside, so by diffusion, potassium is going to want to rush outside the cell, and as that positive charge rushes outside the cell, what happens to the charge inside? Does it become more positive when potassium leaves? No, it becomes more negative inside the cell, right, when potassium leaves, because potassium is a cation. So when potassium leaves the cell, that produces, what do we call this? Deviation from a positive charge back down to resting membrane potential. Repolarization. So action potential has depolarization due to sodium, has repolarization due to potassium, and I even see a little bit of an overshoot that we're going to talk about in just a second. Okay, so this initial stimulus has to reach this dotted line in order for an action potential to take place. If this depolarization doesn't reach the dotted line, then that information is just going to die away, and the cell is going to go back down to resting membrane potential, and it won't stimulate an action potential. So this dotted line is what we call a threshold. So whenever a depolarization reaches threshold, that will cause an action potential to ensue as a result of that. So this stimulus that's drawn on this curve, is this a threshold stimulus or a sub-threshold stimulus? Sub means below. Is this a below threshold or a threshold stimulus? It's a threshold stimulus because it has changed the membrane potential to this level. It looks like minus 55, for instance. And minus 55 is the voltage that will then cause a conformation change of this membrane protein from a closed channel to an open channel when the voltage across the membrane changes. Okay? Okay. And then we see that depolarization stops right here. Why is that? Well, because it's a gated channel. Not only can it open, but when the gate closes, and if this is a sodium channel, right, when the gate closes, what happens to the inflow of sodium? It stops, right? So at this point in time, sodium can no longer enter the cell because the gate is closed. And now what is predominating or controlling what this action potential does is potassium leaking out through a potassium channel. And that causes repolarization. All right, so we got resting membrane voltage, threshold voltage. And as a matter of fact, we could consider this excited or a threshold stimulus. We could consider a threshold stimulus in terms of the voltage that has to be applied to the cell to get it right into this action potential. And what does it look like here? Minus 70 to minus 55, that would be what? A 15 millivolt stimulus. If it was a 10 millivolt stimulus, if it went from minus 70 to 60, that would be a sub-threshold stimulus. And an action potential would not take place. Okay, so here is an action potential. Let's look back to the left-hand part of the slide. And here we're going to see something interesting. So here is a stimulus, and we know that to be a depolarizing stimulus. So a depolarizing stimulus is going to affect some voltage-gated channels, right? Both potassium and sodium. It first will have an effect on the sodium. Sodium are fast channels. So as soon as threshold voltage is reached, then voltage-gated sodium channels open. Okay, and what happens to sodium? Diffuses into the cell because of the electrochemical gradient diffuses in. And as sodium diffuses into the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It causes more depolarization. And that causes more voltage-gated sodium channels to open. And what happens to sodium? More sodium can enter the cell, which causes more depolarization, which causes more voltage-gated channels to open. What does that sound like? What kind of feedback is that? Where something causes even more of that to happen over and over and over again. That is positive feedback. So here's an example of positive feedback being a very normal and necessary thing inside your body. So depolarization of an action potential is due to a positive feedback mechanism. Okay. Now how come all cells in the world aren't depolarized? Because this positive feedback mechanism sure seems like the inside of the cell is going to become more positive and more positive and more positive. How come we're just not all positive inside the cell? What changes this positive feedback mechanism? This gate right here, right? When it depolarizes to a certain level, this gate closes, and then the cell can no longer depolarize to sodium. So that's what breaks that positive feedback mechanism. Okay. With the depolarizing stimulus, there's another voltage-gated channel, but that is potassium. It's a little bit slower to open, which means then that potassium won't be able to leave the cell until a later time, and now we have potassium leaving the cell after depolarization, and when potassium leaves, that causes repolarization. All right, so that depolarization opens up these slow potassium-gated channels. Potassium diffuses out of the cell, and when a positive charge leaves the cell, what happens to the charge inside the cell? When a positive leaves, the inside becomes more negative, and that causes repolarization. So this yellow right here represents positive feedback, which is not a common thing in a normal homeostatically controlled mechanism inside your body. Here's a really good example of that. Okay, so do you have a sense of this action potential? Can you picture why sodium is entering the cell when all of a sudden a pathway is open for it? And when it enters the cell, can you picture why the cell becomes more positive? Because sodium is a cation, right? And can you picture in your mind when potassium leaves the cell that the membrane potential becomes more negative? Why is that? Because potassium is a cation, has a positive charge. When it leaves, the inside becomes more negative. Okay. All right. So here is an action potential. Let me look at the next slide. Yeah, we talked about that already. Repolarization, the sodium channels. Now, for repolarization, it says here the sodium channels are closed. Why are the voltage-gated sodium channels closed for repolarization? Because why? Because it's gated, because of this gate right here. All right, what else do we see right here? Electrochemical gradient drives potassium outward. That causes repolarization back to resting membrane potential. Indeed, it does. All right, so depolarization and repolarization occur passively, just by diffusion, right, as a result of the chemical gradient and as a result of the electrical gradient, because sodium and potassium have this, they are electrolytes, they have this positive charge. And after an action potential takes place, then the sodium-potassium pump starts to pump out sodium because it entered the cell. It then pumps potassium into the cell because the cell has lost potassium, and it brings the concentration in and outside of the cell back exactly to normal because that's what the sodium-potassium pump does. All right, well, we're going to start here next time. Maybe review that action potential a little bit. And that would be good.